Hi, and welcome to the New Health Club podcast. Psychedelics are experiencing a renaissance, developing into a tool to help us go through life. But what are LSD, magic mushrooms, psilocybin and MDMA or ketamine are exactly doing for our mental health, personal progress and optimization? Will they change our lifestyles and lives forever? I'm sure they will. On the New Health Club podcast, I talk to real innovators, thought leaders and disruptors from the emerging world of psychedelics. So please listen and enjoy. This podcast deals with drugs. Drugs are dangerous. Furthermore, the use and or trade of drugs can be punishable by law. Please keep this in mind. This podcast is not suitable for people under the age of 18. Hello and welcome to a new episode of the New Health Club podcast. We hope you're safe and well. Today I talk to Lars Christian Wilde, the president and co-founder at Compass Pathways in London. Compass Pathways is a mental health care company, a company that's dedicated to accelerate patients' access to evidence-based innovation in mental health. Compass is currently researching how psilocybin therapy could help people with treatment-resistant depression. I did the podcast with Lars at one of the first days of everybody's new Zoom and FaceTime life. We are slowly getting there now, like everybody. And we're happy to see that even Jimmy Kimmel is broadcasting from home in a suit, whereas I am spending my days in a Lululemon yoga pants. Lars and I talked about the new investor business of magic mushrooms or psilocybin and why psilocybin-infused gummy bears won't be the future. We talk about why we can see comic characters in a psilocybin treatment and why we might use this as a creative source soon. But of course, we also talk about the current corona crisis. So, will we ever come back from our OCD hand-washing that is saving us right now? And might the crisis now lead to a light PTSD for everyone and brings out mental health topics that we are already carrying in ourselves? Lars is also explaining to me a possible vaccine for mental health disorders that we might have in a few years and that might be useful in a situation that we are experiencing now. So we have a few things covered for you in such wild times. And now over to Lars. First of all, everybody talks about the crisis, but before we talk about the crisis, it would be great to, if you could introduce yourself to our listeners at the New Health Club.
Great, I'd love to. Yeah, I think where do I best start? I think I do it chronologically. So I'm Lars. I'm German, as people will realize from my accent. And I have a background in business. I went to business school and then I worked as an investor in healthcare investing, was involved in building Viva Neo, which is a German, actually it's now a cross-continental a group of in vitro fertilization clinics, and then became a serial entrepreneur and started several companies in tech and e-commerce. One of those companies I ran as the founding CEO. And when a couple of things in my private life went south and a good friend of mine very unexpectedly died, who I was working with in my company, I developed a severe anxiety disorder first. And I called a friend and asked him to, what should I do? I'm running a company with 120 people. I can't be panicking all the time.
Wow.
And he put me on an SSRI. And I think in hindsight, the SSRI actually triggered an episode of depression.
Wow.
And
okay.
Again, I picked up my phone, called my friend, and I was put on a tricyclic, which is still fairly widely prescribed in psychiatry. And I feel that for most patients, it shouldn't be. And I gained 20 kilograms of weight. I felt dumber than I usually do.
well, it's not funny though.
I didn't have my cognitive abilities and really I felt muted. And so I sensed that in the background there was still the lingering anxiety, the depression, but my emotional status both positive and negative, was basically gone. So I was indifferent to everything. And so I battled with that for a year. Mm-hmm. And then decided that I had to leave the company that I had started, because everything there reminded me of the friend that I had lost, who worked there with me. And so I informed my board of directors and my investors, and I was very upright, because I felt that it's important that people speak out about mental health issues. And I felt that, especially in Germany, that is still highly stigmatized, despite the fact yeah. that in my own company, I had several people that suffered from what we in Germany call very heroically burnout, which just mm-hmm. is severe major depressive disorder. And so I was very happy to see how much compassion I received from my investors. And Christian Angermeyer, who you also know and who was in one of your earlier podcasts, is one of my closest friends. And he has been an investor in the first company that I started. And he reached out to me and said, "Hey, Lars, sorry to hear about you, but are you aware of psilocybin?" And I didn't know the word. Mm-hmm. I had to look it up, actually, and realized it's the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. And I, you know, at that time I was battling with anxiety disorder. So the last thing I wanted to do is do something that's frightening. And I came across the amazing research from UCLA, Hopkins, NYU, Imperial. And I realized that psilocybin seemed to be physically safe. And I also understood the arguments that the researchers made, why they saw such strong efficacy in the signal-generating studies that they had conducted. And to cut a long story short, I then called Christian again and said, "Hey, Christian, you know, this all sounds too good to be true. How, you know, what do you know?" And he said, "Well, I can help you to have a high-dose psilocybin mushroom experience." And that I did. And I went into this experience still having panic attacks and anxiety and depression. And within 6 hours, I came out of that experience, and the anxiety was gone, the depression was gone, the ruminatory thinking was gone. And yeah, I was just blown away by how powerful the experience was and the effects of it. And I kept getting better for a week until I really plateaued in what I can only describe as a state of euphoria. I felt plugged in again. I wanted to do things. And I thought about, you know, should I return to the company that I've started, had started? And I realized, you know, they were better off without me. The other companies were too. And so I needed to figure out what to do next. And I was really intrigued by this, because then after that experience, I dug really deep into the research, and I realized how much work had been done after Sandoz, Novartis, discovered LSD and then later synthesized psilocybin, and that 40,000 patients in the 50s and 60s and even 70s had been treated with those substances, and most studies yielded really strong results. And so I, at that point, I realized, you know, it was not only a lucky coincidence that I got better, but that there must be others that would benefit from that. And my first inclination was to go to the Netherlands and start a group of mental health care clinics and then treat people that don't respond with a natural product, let's say. That is a neat business model, but it doesn't scale to the global need of depression. And through lucky coincidence, again, I was introduced through Christian to my co-founders, Katja and George, mm-hmm. In London, and realized that we share very similar stories, and that they had been on this path for a couple of years earlier already, looking at funding academic research. They had started their own nonprofit and started donating their money to clinical research, to academic research, and realized mm-hmm. that there needed to be a path to patients in terms of academic research, clinical research. And so I realized that they had done a lot of the important hard work to talk to regulators and understand what it takes to develop this as a therapy, really, and get approval globally. And that's when I joined them. We started Compass as a for-profit entity, because we realized that it would take hundreds of millions to run the late-stage clinical trials, the commercial build-out, the therapist training, and everything that goes with it. And 3 years later, we're in the midst of our phase 2B program in treatment-resistant depression in North America and Europe. We have completed the largest controlled psilocybin study done to date at King's College London, where we looked at cognition. And we're planning to expand our portfolio into other indications where we believe that the underlying mechanisms of mental health suffering are the same. What do I do at Compass? I'm co-founder, president, and chief business officer. I have spent a lot of time looking at making sure the company is well-funded to do all the necessary work. I spend a lot of time on building the organization, and I look at strategic initiatives of where we can and have to take the company next, because obviously this is not just another pill that people take twice a day or three times a day. This is an intervention, so to say, in people's lives, which should happen very infrequently if they work well. And so to think about what is the model behind this is a big part of my job.
So it is kind of, I mean, I remember like you guys were the first company that was in the media for this, that to create real medication that is basically coming out of psilocybin, right? I mean, you could say that. So, and I mean, of course, like the big topic since then, I feel, and I've been to this conference in New York where just there seemed to be like the Horizons conference, two kind of sides, that one side would say, no, there always has to be like a mystical experience related to taking psilocybin or LSD. And that's why that side would say, okay, it can't be a medication because you would not have that actually. So which of course means immediately that, like you say, a lot of people could never do this because nobody can just, I mean, not everybody who would need this could go to a fancy place and just spend like 3 weeks on psilocybin. Not everybody can do this actually. So what do you say? I mean, what is your main argument if people say, well, what you guys are doing is like taking away the psychedelic experience?
Well, I think that is, we have been confronted with that argument oftentimes, but that is clearly not what we're doing, because we firmly believe that the psychedelic experience is contributing to the beneficial effects of psilocybin therapy. When you look at the mechanism of action, as it has been investigated by, for example, the University of Zurich and Imperial College London, there seems to be a very strong correlation between the downregulation of the default mode network and the duration of the antidepressant effects of psilocybin therapy. And that downregulation of the default mode network correlates very highly with the mystical experience. So I think it's very hard to take the so-called mystical experience out of the experience in general. I think how we think about it is that we are a mental health care company, and it happens to be that psilocybin seems to, for us, to be the most promising technology at the moment to develop for patients to make them get better. However, we don't go into the therapy with expecting a certain experience for patients. We believe that whatever experience shows up for the patient is exactly the right experience for the patient to work through. And then also our therapy model is designed to help patients to integrate exactly their experience without telling them that they, you know, need to see the light or whatever comes up for them. Because frankly, for some people, they process trauma. For other people, they have a blissful experience where they feel one with the universe for 6 hours. And again, others just work through their relationships and realize what relationships serve them and which relationships don't. And then afterwards, the big question is, what does it mean for their lives specifically, and how do they integrate that and make the necessary changes to hopefully stay out of depression and stay in a state of mental well-being?
Well, there's going to be another Netflix thing now called Have a Good Trip, like celebrities talking about their psychedelic experiences, but not, you don't see them, you see like comic characters. I can't wait for this actually, because I thought, like when I did this my treatment in Synthesis in Amsterdam, I saw, like, I feel like I saw 5 million comic characters, like, from starting from Peter Pan, like, basically Tinkerbell, to Ariel, like, the mermaid. And I mean, and a lot of people that I talked to, so, yeah, I have this too. I saw this weird many Mickey Mouses in a very different kind of costume. So, yeah. I mean, I find this very interesting that psilocybin obviously has a very, also like a very strong creative power to just bring out other, I mean, LSD has a certain other quality, but I find psilocybin has almost like, you could almost shoot like 20 movies or maybe even more after just having an experience. Right. So why is that? Why is it such a creative state of mind, actually? What do you think?
So the probably the scientific answer, and I'm mindful, I'm not a scientist, so I'm butchering what esteemed academic colleagues would say. Like, if I think in terms of Robin Card Harris's work for Imperial College London, I think what they observed is that the default mode network, which is kind of the master organizing principle between the different brain areas, is downregulated, which allows for increased communication between the otherwise separate brain areas. And so this gives people under the influence of psilocybin or LSD the ability to have what some people describe as this 360 degree ability to think and be creative. And some people experience synesthesia, meaning that different senses merge into one. So suddenly you smell colors or you see sounds, etc. And so I think this is an interesting a mechanism that on the therapeutic side helps patients to probably see problems that they thought were, they could only look at from one perspective, from a very different perspective, and reevaluate whether they actually have the real, if their sense of how they perceive their problem is actually the objective way to see a problem. When you look at patients that have come out of some of the studies in the US and in Europe, they often describe that they found a new way to see their life, to see the problems, to see the path that led them to where they are. And they could also make connections to your point about creativity on how to design their life going forward. And I think that speaks to the psychotherapeutic inbuilt ability of psilocybin, that patients can see a path forward that is different from the path they saw before. And that's therapeutic in itself. And so I think in therapy, that is one of the neat things about psilocybin. And obviously outside of therapy, other people use it differently, right? I think some of the greatest music that has ever been made in the 60s and 70s has been made under the influence of LSD. So clearly there's a creative aspect to this.
Yeah, I think I once read that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards actually didn't like each other, but then they went on a trip together and they were like, oh, let's do this great music together. I mean, it's a short version, but that's actually, it seems to be true. So, but I mean, since you're coming from the business side, so there was recently this article in the New York Times saying, okay, VCs are ready for mushrooms, basically. So, obviously, right now, or like another article said, the race is on with investing in psychedelics. So, and also a lot of articles said that some investors are turning away from cannabis because they also don't want to really support like a legalization. They rather feel comfortable with a decriminalization. So, how would you, for example, I think the guy from Shark Tank. Timothy O'Leary. Yeah, okay. O'Leary, they all have this Leary thing, kind of. So how is your take on the current investor situation? How would you describe this? Is there like a hysteria? Is there like, oh God, you have to get into this? And what is the outlook?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think there are different investor groups that think about this very differently. And I think there has been a hype building up until 3 weeks ago when we saw the worst market crash since the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So I think some of that irrational exuberance is hopefully gone now. I think the way that we look at this is really from a therapeutic angle. And so the investors that we talk to are investors that see that there's a clear need for change in psychiatry and psychology. And that are excited about the prospects of psilocybin therapy, but also MDMA therapy for PTSD and the various forms of ketamine developed for acute suicidality, for example. And so they understand that the model of psychiatry will likely change in the coming 5 to 10 years, where treatments will be more, as I said, more kind of intermittent, where you have one experience and that improves and you work on mm-hmm. yourself, and only if you get depressed again, you come back. Mm-hmm. So you're not hooked on a medication for life. And so the investors that understand that, they want to build something that is really revolutionizing mental health, they are investing on the medical side of things. Mm-hmm. To the point, the run on mushrooms, I think that is, there are a lot of players in the field that come out of the cannabis industry and they have mm-hmm. seen what happened in the cannabis market, and they believe, you know, they look at probably the drug charts and look at what drugs have the best risk or abuse liability, or the lowest abuse liability, and they quickly stumble over psilocybin, which is physically mm-hmm. very safe, and when given in a therapeutic setting, also psychologically extremely safe. So I think that's where this is coming from originally, and then there are a lot of companies that are now trying to build something in the psychedelic space. I think a lot of that is really misguided. I think there are a lot of people chasing something that doesn't really exist, because right now, there, with very few exceptions, there are no legal jurisdictions where psychedelic experiences can be had. So I think that a lot of people that are now creating psilocybin-infused gummy bears are probably building a product that will not be able to go to market.
Just in a very few places in the world, maybe, right? I mean, just Boulder, Colorado, for example.
Yeah, and I think even there, right, I think people make the mistake to confuse decriminalization with legalization, mm-hmm. Which I did too in the beginning, because for me it sounded like, okay, if it's not criminal anymore, then it must be legal. But there's a very fine distinction in that it basically means if somebody catches you with the gummy bear I just talked about, it's the lowest priority of law enforcement, and likely you're going to be let go. However, mm-hmm. on a federal level, obviously, this is still, you're still dealing with a Schedule 1 substance, so it mm-hmm. could yield a couple of years in jail. And I'm a big fan of drug decriminalization. I think it's also misguided to just talk about, you know, decriminalizing psychedelic drugs, because, again, not all psychedelic drugs are safe. I think that's something I keep hearing, that all psychedelic drugs are safe, but some of the most widely used psychedelic drugs, like the N-BOMe class, which often is confused with LSD on blotter paper, leads to vasoconstriction, and people die on this every weekend. So I think it's actually dangerous to say that all psychedelics are safe. I think that for me, when I look at Portugal, that's a fantastic example of what generalized decriminalization can mean for people that suffer from drug addiction. And it can help people to come out of that stigma and be able to deal with their addiction. So I think that the right thing to do is to talk about more broad drug decriminalization. And that is something that, you know, I'm a fan of, but that's not what we engage in as a company, obviously, because we're really focusing on developing a therapeutic model. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we go about this. And I think so. There's a lot of money chasing things that don't really exist, and I don't see a model where those will exist anytime soon.
Yeah. No, I mean, I know what you mean. Yeah, but it looks like it's almost, it's interesting. The more you read about it, the more you're under the impression of, well, it's there tomorrow. It's like, yay, you wake up on Thursday and psilocybin is there. But it's not, of course. Yeah, that's the big thing. But I mean, what I find interesting, though, is like, and I talked to the podcast that's actually another thing then too, when this is running, with talked to Ben Sessa about it yesterday from Bristol. And that, I mean, you could think that after this whole crisis we're experiencing now, that a lot of people will actually kind of suffer from a certain kind of PTSD after this is over, especially when the danger is kind of over, but you still feel like you, oh God, I don't know, I still have the anxiety in me. And I'm wondering, for example, will I still wash my hands in this OCD way, like after this thing is over? Is it a good thing maybe? I don't know. So, and I find interesting, so obviously psychedelics are new tools for new things that are required from us in new times. So do you think that, let's say, fast forward like half a year later, if this hopefully is fine, everything, and it's just kind of developed in a good direction. So, but still, again, like a lot of people will be under the influence of what they experience, and not everybody is really good at that. Just some people are strong and they used to this, but a lot of people just are terrified to death right now, even if they do everything right. So do you think there will be like a, I don't know, let's call it medication or a treatment that could be like a, yeah, like a psychedelic treatment for this? Do you think that would come out of this eventually?
I think that is a, that's a very interesting question to think through.
It's a company, basically.
Indeed, I mean, with all major shocks to human society, you've always seen trauma, right? I think, you know, our parents or grandparents have been traumatized generations, and that trauma is, we know that it's both biologically and through behavior passed on from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. The effects lessen over time, but clearly there's something there. And I think that's one of the interesting questions to understand if psilocybin, MDMA, actually go to that epigenetic level of trauma. And I, based on the animal studies that have been done and have been seen, it seems that those substances have the ability to reverse epigenetic trauma, which is very interesting, right?
Yeah, sure.
That takes me very concretely to your point, right? You know, we don't know how bad it gets, right? I'm a big believer of, you know, preparing for the worst and then hoping for the best. And so I think, you know, I'm very positive about what I'm seeing, what other players in the biotech and pharma industry are building right now, and how quickly you're learning, and drugs that are being repurposed. So I think within 3 months or so, we should be on top of this epidemic. But to your point, people will die until then. Other people will be traumatized and afraid. And so if that reaches a clinical level, I hope that within a few years' time, MDMA therapy will be approved. I hope psilocybin therapy will be approved, so that people can access those treatments if they have to. I think that that is our objective. We are very much focused on broad access. That's why very early on we have started to work with the payer organizations in Europe to make sure this is not a niche treatment only affordable for the few, because that's a problem that we see with the retreats, right? I think, you know, Synthesis is doing an amazing job to create a great experience, and I know friends of mine that have gone through it and they only speak in the highest tones about it, but it's expensive. And my friends can afford it, but there are many people, especially people that suffer from mental health problems, that can't afford it. Yeah. And so we need to be able to generate a model that is reimbursable so that people that need it most can afford it. And so, you know, when you talk about entire populations that are traumatized, that clearly then you need a model and you need to be able to make a case why such a treatment should be paid for.
Well, I mean, honestly, since I'm getting into this and reading more about it, my feeling, I mean, I did a podcast, it's also on, you can listen to it, it's with David Bronner about his generation, kind of generational trauma and the Holocaust. And I mean, since we talked about this and talked to other people about it, whose grandparents were in the camp, and it's interesting. I feel sometimes Germans are still under PTSD, the ones that did it and the ones that suffered from it. And I mean, it sounds like, yeah, well, now you think everybody has PTSD. But I feel sometimes how the people react now, like the way, for example, they're shopping food, it's like, to me, this is strongly related to behavior after the Second World War or in the Second World War. And I'm totally convinced that there are still some generational things that are happening now where people just put on their survival mode and they don't even realize that they're doing it in the way that they kind of shop things that they So I really think that there is so much kind of post-traumatic stress also with Second World War. That's, I'm totally convinced. Even in a lot of Germans that are in a generation that it's young now, kind of, I feel.
I think the thing about multi-generational trauma, it sounds so woo-woo for most people.
It's not, no.
But when you look at the science, you know, when you look at early rodent models that were done where initially to understand epigenetic changes and how they are passed on from generation to generation, it's very interesting. Just picking one example, when you make a mouse fed by feeding the mouse a child that they're not usually fed with, and once that mouse is fed and has offsprings, the offsprings will be fed too, and they will create fed offsprings, irrespective of what you feed them thereafter. And so that was one of the triggers that helped people to understand that external information can be transcribed on the DNA level through the folding mechanisms and methylation. And so when that was discovered, also it was discovered later that once you shock a mouse, for example, that certain behavior that the mouse after the trauma expresses, that is also passed on from generation to generation, which evolutionary is a great mechanism, right? If I think about us humans, right, you walk through the woods and suddenly your tribe is attacked by a brown bear. And it eats two of your family members. You're traumatized by that event. But what it means is when you hear something in the bushes the next time, when, you know, we were hunters and gatherers and we're roaming through the woods and you heard something in the bushes, you were prepared to run. And so that is, you know, that such mechanisms are passed on from generation to generation. If we were still hunter-gatherers, makes a lot of sense. But we're living much more complex lives in much more complex societies these days, that those adaptations don't benefit us anymore. But clearly, we're still naked monkeys in a modern world. And so those mechanisms still express themselves in our behaviors and patterns. And so we see that in trauma clearly. And there are good studies on that that have been done in human populations as well, where you see certain behaviors expressed in entire populations after they suffered through genocide, for example, where those behaviors are not expressed in other populations. And so I think it's interesting to think about it. I don't think it needs to necessarily be a psychedelic experience that helps people to process that. I think psychotherapy can play a big part in that as well, but it's a phenomenon that a lot of people are aware of.
And I mean, when do you think, I mean, what is your outlook, when do you think the medication will be available, or what is the timeline that you're thinking of?
Yeah, so we're a good way through our phase 2B program, and you know, once that phase B program is completed somewhere next year, we're going into our phase 3 program, which realistically is another 2 years. And, you know, there might be a hiccup left and right. You never know. We're still talking about clinical trials. And so realistically, I think within the next 4 to 5 years, we could see psilocybin therapy be approved for treatment-resistant depression first and then other indications following thereafter. I think Rick is doing a great job at MAPS. I think they could be available at least in the US earlier with MDMA for PTSD, which I think is the first class of this kind of broadly psychedelic therapy, I would call it. So faster than some people think, actually.
Yeah. And do you think, what do you think about, like, I mean, this is like, of course, the treatment resistant thing is a very pressing thing. But I mean, it also seems that a lot of people, or more people, are getting into this idea to use it as a tool of answering big life questions, even if you're like a healthy person or you're not depressed. But maybe you are more than you think also. In a way, sometimes with episodes that you kind of, like you said, play down as burnout or just exhaustion, but then you realize it's actually maybe in the experience you realize that it's more than that, maybe. So, but what do you think about this idea to really integrate this as a regular, let's call it even lifestyle tool, like going, I mean, I'm exaggerating now, by going to yoga or going to the gym?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. Maybe worthwhile to think through what is the framework under which we're operating,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
There's the FDA, there's the European Medicines Agency, and their clear objective is to solve unmet medical needs through rigorous science and approving drugs for patients. And so that's what we engage in. There are currently no pathways that would allow us to develop something for, let's call it, personal development or improvement.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, I think that there could be another way to look at this, right? I think depression, addiction, OCD, anxiety, oftentimes they have biographical triggers. And mm-hmm. it seems that patients are able to work through those biographical issues in their psychedelic experiences. And so one argument that I heard, and I think is an interesting one to think through, is that those substances could also be used someday as a vaccine, so to say, to shield people from developing mental health disorders in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Or after they had a traumatic event. Mm-hmm. So one anecdote that I heard from a Special Forces soldier is that in his specific unit, people that returned from a mission had the opportunity to use MDMA to process what they went through in that mission.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say which army, but it was interesting because clearly in no jurisdiction MDMA is approved as a therapeutic, but that specific special unit decided to use that treatment modality for their soldiers to prevent them from developing PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that a fair amount of his comrades was actually engaging in that when they went through a particularly traumatizing mission. So, you know, within maybe 10 years, 20 years, once this treatment has been approved and has shown efficacy in various indications, one could make the argument to think about using those substances in that way.
We're looking forward to that. Okay, thank you so much. I mean, that was super interesting. I wanted to talk way more about business, but you have such an interesting way of talking about things that just we have to do another one maybe very soon because